In the words of Catherine O'Hara's Moira Rose, my favorite season is awards, and we are in the thick of it. With Oscar nominations coming out this past week, movie fans and film critics alike have entered the final stage of the annual ritual, discussing, celebrating, and in some cases hotly debating which films from the past year deserve a spot in cinema history. Of all critics groups, guilds, and online awards, the Broadcast Film Critics Association's annual Critics' Choice Awards are one of the larger award ceremonies. I'm Kyle Alvarado, sitting in for, well, actually in this case, sitting next to Charles Horak, and welcome to On Film.
Thank you, Kyle. Thank you. And thank you for filling in.
Oh, always happy to. So this is a rare treat for us. I get to interview the host of this show.
Yes, it's unusual sitting on this side of the table.
So let's kind of start at the start. You are a member of the Broadcast Film Critics Association, and they hosted their awards. So what did you think of the winners overall? Were they in line with your personal ballot?
Well, frankly, being at the awards presentation in L.A. is a bit dizzying. It's disorienting, and I can't always keep track of who's winning what because you're so busy scoping out the audience for all of the A-list actors and directors and people that you'd like to meet and talk to. So, I think a few surprises for me is that, you know, coming off the Golden Globes, I was very surprised that Joaquin Phoenix won Best Actor for Joker, and he went on to win at our awards show, which, you know, is a fine performance. It's not the one I voted for, but he now has two major awards stacked up going into the Oscar race, which for a lot of people means a lot.
Yeah.
Often the front runners make it all the way.
Mm-hmm. And it should be noted that the BFCA, their awards, are considered a bellwether for the Oscars, I think, more than any group. Your winners tend to align with Academy choices.
Yeah, somebody's done the math that the Critics' Choice Awards, which I vote in and which I just came back from, are the best predictor of the nominations that the Oscars will do. And in fact, the nominations came out Monday, the very day after our award show, and they aligned almost entirely with our nomination list. And so we'll see what happens at the end of February when the actual awards come out. But, you know, there were some other surprises for me. Renee Zellweger for Judy also won a Golden Globe Award. So that was a bit of a head scratcher. I thought there were better performances. Best Picture, too. Once Upon a Time in Hollywood won Best Picture, Quentin Tarantino's film, which I frankly think is his best film and an important filmmaker in the American cinema. It's, again, not the one I voted for, but we have 10 nominees.
Yeah.
And so it would be fascinating. We never get the numbers, the accounting behind it, but with 10 nominees, you wonder how the vote distribution worked.
Yeah.
If everybody spread their votes equally, then technically, I guess the one that got 10% of the vote plus one would win Best Picture. So I like to focus more on the nomination list. I think every award season, one or two awards getters makes the point that is there such a thing as a best film or a best performance?
Yeah.
That, you know, I like to look at the more rounded categories of all the nominees to say, you know, all of these are worthy of attention as well as many more. So it's a bit of a parlor game to me to try to pick the very best of the year.
Yeah. So one of the things that I like a lot about the Critics' Choice Awards more than kind of the other groups is that nominations and awards are handed out specifically to genre films, action, comedy, sci-fi, and horror.
Sure.
When you're sort of approaching these lists and you're evaluating these films, is it different from how you vote for Best Picture overall? How do you approach voting separately?
I try not to myself, but I think it's only natural human psychology to do so. You know, we were the first awards group to create an animated feature film category. And then the Oscars adopted that several years after us. And it's great to shine a light on, say, horror, science fiction, comedy, because they rarely make it onto the best picture list. The downside of that, by creating those separate categories, while you are honoring those films that sometimes don't get the appreciation they deserve, including animated, there are years where I think an animated film or a comedy or a science fiction film deserves to be on the best picture list. And so what I fear sometimes happens among some voters, I try not to let it happen to me, is that they think, well, I've only got so many slots on my ballot to fill out for best picture. I really liked film X, but it's an animated film. So I know I can put that in the best animated category. Therefore, I'll leave it off my best picture list. same goes for, I think, foreign language films. So this year, for instance, one of the two greatest films I saw was the South Korean film Parasite, which I nominated for Best Picture, and indeed it showed up on our Best Picture list.
Tied for Best Director, too.
Tied for Best Director as well. And it did win Best Foreign Language Film. It was in both categories. Occasionally, you'll see a Pixar film or something float up onto the Best Picture list. To me, The Lighthouse was one of my favorite films of the year. Really powerful experience seeing it in a theater. I nominated it for a Best Picture, but it fell down into one of the genre categories.
Yeah.
I think the year that Blade Runner 2049 was on the Oscar Best Picture list was an important milestone, because we rarely, again, see science fiction films make it up onto Best Picture lists.
No.
So, you know, I think all in all, it's a good thing for us to have genre categories, but I do worry sometimes that there are special films that get relegated to that when they could just have easily been on the Best Picture list.
Yeah. And just so our listeners know, the winners for Best Action, Sci-Fi, and Comedy are Avengers Endgame, Us, and Dolomite Is My Name, respectively. So just going back to the awards show real quick, the award show itself, who were some of the actors and filmmakers you mingled with and maybe even connected with this year?
You know, it's, as I said earlier, it's a dizzying experience to be in a room like that, and you kind of have to psych yourself up for it and just put yourself out there. But it is a target-rich environment, if you will. You know, the pre-show, when we're all just kind of milling about for the 2 hours, and the red carpet, in this case, a blue carpet, is emptying into the venue, set up like a dinner theater similar to the Golden Globes, so you're all around large tables. It's very informal when the show is not running. And you do have an opportunity to go and find people. And I had a wonderful conversation with a favorite actor of mine, Jared Harris, from Chernobyl, which won Best Television Miniseries at our award show. He was also in an incredible short series called The Terror that I extol the virtues of to anyone I can. So we talked about both of those shows. Certainly meeting the cast of The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, a favorite show in my household, was delightful. But you know, I sort of like to go for the icons. So talking to Robert De Niro was an incredible experience. We got to, a lot of people don't know that Texas is the repository of his archive, that the great Harry Ransom Center at the UT Austin campus, he's been funneling a lot of his materials there over the last few years. That's where his archive exists. And so we talked a bit about that. I know the curator there, and I talked about how important it was that all of those materials for study and enjoyment are in Texas. So
yeah.
We had that common. Rita Moreno was there, who has been to El Paso and I knew from the Plaza Classic Film Festival, so I got to catch up with her. I think a highlight for me was getting to talk to and meet Norman Lear, a true icon, just before he actually won an award for the live telecasts that they did last year of All in the Family and the Jeffersons. So talking to someone like that, that goes back and has such a storied history in television and pioneering television, he's 97 and still vibrant. So there's a lot of people, Taika Waititi, and it just goes on and on.
So when you're, you know, we'll use Norman Lear as an example, when you're getting ready to go meet him, is there, you know, one burning question you've always had, or do you just sort of go and say, what's up?
You know, I think people like that, I try to just impart somehow my appreciation for what they've, you know, what part they've played in my life, because my life has been most of it geared around watching things.
Yeah.
And when I meet an icon like that, I tend to want to first impart that appreciation. And he was genuinely moved by the people coming up to him that night. I wasn't the only one seeking him out and telling him similar things. You know, beyond that, if it's a Robert De Niro, where I have a connection with, you know, the HRC in Austin, you know, we have that common conversation. Yeah. And you see them drop their guard a little bit, you know, when there is something you can both latch onto, some common thread. So sometimes just something specific, you know, Taika Waititi, I spoke about what a high wire act and ambitious project Jojo Rabbit was, which starts as a comedy and ends as a drama tragedy, and uses Adolf Hitler initially as a comedic element in a film. I mean, there are so many red flags going off when I saw the trailer for that film, and I was astonished how he was able to navigate that material. with all the pitfalls that come with it and somehow avoid them, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And he talked about that high wire act. So in that case, we got very specific about the film.
Okay. Very cool. We have time for one more question, and we'll keep the answer just a little bit short. But I'm genuinely curious about this. You know, as award season has become, you know, competitive and as bitter as certain political elections in recent years, as a film critic, is there ever a concern that the campaign matters or makes more noise than the film itself?
Yeah. So when you say campaign, I think the secret behind all of these lists, whether it's our own Critics' Choice Award nominations or the Oscars nominations that just rolled out, when you look at that list for the common viewer, it may look like, you know, all the best films have floated to the top. What listeners need to understand is that every single one of those titles, it's remarkable year after year, had an awards campaign behind it. Mm-hmm. So there are some really fine films that I like during the year that if the studio or distributor does not devote sometimes $1 million to pushing to critics groups, to the voting groups that are out there, you will never see them. So this is still a short collection of a slightly broader collection of films that had a lot of money and campaigns behind them to position them for an award. And there's a lot of psychology that we could talk about on another show that goes into that. So that is one of the things that always strikes me, is there's often never a dark horse or a surprise. They are consensus picks, and they are good films, but there are often other smaller films that are just as good that get left by the wayside because they don't have the money or time or a studio behind them to push it.
My guest today has been BFCEA member, On Film host, and my friend and mentor, Charles Horak. Charles, as mentioned, is a member of the BFCEA, which hosted its annual Critics' Choice Awards this past week, crowning Once Upon a Time in Hollywood as its best picture of the year. On Film's producer and engineer is Seth Van Meter. An archive of past programs can be found at ktep.org. I'm Kyle Alvarado, sitting next to Charles Horak, and thanks for joining us for On Film.